Hi, my name is Mr. Bodwell. I am the editor of VictorianAdventureEnthusiast.com. And today I am with Joe McDaldno, creator of Perfect, a storytelling game of dystopian thought crime. Is that a good summation there, Joe?
Yeah, I'd say so. I would either tell you that it's a steampunk dystopia, a game of criminals in a steampunk dystopia, or I would tell you it's like a steampunk version of A Clockwork Orange.
So why a steampunk version of Clockwork Orange as opposed to just playing Clockwork Orange?
That's a good question.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You thought there'd be no good questions because this blank piece of paper in front of me is blank.
Yeah, I thought it would just kind of meditate on the blankness of the page. Well, first of all, I'm not very excited by the very drab, kind of ever-present technology aesthetic of A Clockwork Orange in 1984. And I was excited for something, I guess, which felt less like a reflection on the modern day and a reflection on modern economics and modern politics. And kind of the dark Victorian or the steampunk aesthetic just jumped out at me. I think that there's also a lot of interesting class issues going on in that kind of genre and in that period. And so it's interesting to play around with those.
Okay. So as opposed to drab, you like the sort of ornate overdressedness of the Victorian era?
Yeah, especially thinking about the idea of that ornateness and that austerity being used as kind of a tool of oppression, and then the more you could convince people to pursue kind of these vain goals of dressing more ornately.
So why isn't it the actual Victorian era? Why did you come up with a sort of fictionalized version, a world called Cadence?
First of all, because I didn't want to do my homework. And second of all, I didn't want people to be in a similar position where sitting down at the game table, they feel like they need to get something correct. I wanted people to be feeling free to just invent, this is the way the world is, because it suits my character and because it's going to tell the story that I want to tell. So putting realism aside and just saying the setting is here for you to tear down frees people up a lot.
So it's based on your personal concept of what would be allegedly Victorian. Is this a lot like your Dostoevsky and murder ballads game you wrote that had, you know, you never read anything but Dostoevsky?
Yeah, exactly, actually. Okay. I mean, I've watched a lot of movies that I would, you know, that I would classify as dystopian movies and that I would classify as, you know, dark Victorian movies. And so I definitely had inspirations, but yeah, I never set out to learn anything about Victorian England and then translate that into the text. That was just like what would be interesting to play around with.
Okay. So this is a story game. It says it's a story game. What the hell is a story game as opposed to being a role-playing game?
I think the two terms basically mean the same thing, but they have different connotations going along with them. So the connotations that I was trying to carry forward when I said a story game is that it's a very tight, structural, kind of procedural game. It's not a wide-open sandbox. This can be about anything you want it to be. It's like, no, this is about criminals, and it's about criminals going out and committing crimes, and then the inspectors that try and track them down and fix them. So I meant that. I also meant that there are specific endgame procedures, and there are specific kind of narrative arcs and narrative possibilities baked into the rules of the game.
So it's not as free-form as most role-playing games. You just don't get to pick an elf and pick out your lightsaber and go from there.
Yeah, and I do think most role-playing games actually do have a certain way that they need to be played. And I guess maybe traditionally role-playing games seem to skirt around that, to say, you know, you can do anything. I think that actually undermines the potential of the game sometimes.
So, I mean, if you have such a specific idea on how this game should be played, do you worry about when other people pick it up who aren't you, that they might get it wrong, that they might approach it in the fashion that you didn't intend it to?
No, I don't think so. A large part of the text of the game goes into how to use each element of the game to create the kind of stories that the game is intended for. So, for example, on your character sheet, there are certifications, and there are freedoms, and there are aspects. And there are sections saying how to use certifications in play, how to use freedoms in play, how to use aspects. Not just what they do mechanically, but here's how you mine them for the story potential that exists within them. So there is a lot of that kind of stuff explicitly spelled out in the text. And then if people are, you know, they're knowledgeable about the way that I'm expecting the game to be played, and they want to go off and kind of to play it differently, then at least they're doing that from an educated standpoint.
So what kinds of crime do the characters execute?
That's a good question. There's a gamut. First of all, in this setting, there's a lot of things that are illegal that in the real world, you know, we take them for granted. Being able to hold hands with a loved one in public, you're not allowed to do that. Being able to kiss outside of wedlock, you're not allowed to do that. Basically, think about something that you would want in life. It's likely that it's illegal in Cadence. So if you just want to say, you know what, I want to love someone, and I want that love to just be simple and pure, And then I want to be, like, brought through the ringer, and I want to have to fight for that simple, pure love. Cool. You can also be like, yeah, I'm a jewelry thief. I break into museums late at night and I steal jewelry. Or you can say, you know, I'm constructing a secret Zeppelin army in my secret warehouse. There's a range.
So how did this the culture of the world Cadence end up so restrictive and so confining of the individual?
Do you mean, like, what is the in-setting?
Yeah, what's the background in the story itself? I mean, it seems pretty severe.
Yeah, so I guess I'll explain the recent history of Cadence. So the way this worked is Cadence always was, is, and always will be, of course, the greatest nation ever on the entire face of the earth. There was maybe a little bit of a bad period where the leaders were all drunk, slovenly, and arrogant, and they would stumble into the parliaments, and they would make dictates that made absolutely no sense, and they were gumming up the works. I mean, of course it was still the greatest nation ever, but it was kind of a bad period. An especially bad ruler died, and the only person left to take the throne was his 16-year-old daughter, Abigail, who showed up to the parliaments terrified. Didn't say a word, refused to make eye contact with anyone, just sat there terrified looking at her hands in her lap. And then, you know, the session got out that day and everyone was really pleased. Wow, we finally got some work done. So she did the exact same thing the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And people praised her for just not interfering, for just taking a back seat. Whether that was out of fear or whatever, that was fine. They didn't care. They were happy that she wasn't wrecking things. And so she decided that she would bind her hands into a single clasped glove and never touch anything when she left her house. She would take a vow of silence to the end of her days. And she would take as many austerity measures as humanly possible in an effort to never do anything or affect anything. And people loved her. Finally, things were back on track. And then she died. And there was no one left to take over the throne. And everyone was all caught up in this idea of, if we just don't ever touch anything, everything will always be perfect. And fast forward through a lot of very shifty lawmaking practices, and we have what we have now, which is that everything is kind of run automatic based on the assumptions about what Queen Abigail would have wanted.
So you have a society that's essentially a cult of personality where individual personalities are suppressed.
Exactly, yeah. And everything is done in the name of a monarch who never did anything and is now long gone.
So how long gone? I mean, do the people, the normal people of Cadence, even know how long it's been since Abigail's been around?
That's not explicitly stated in the book. And the reason for that is that sometimes someone at the table will want to say, well, I still remember when Queen Abigail was alive. As a young child, I was actually a secret lover of hers. And now I'm like, you know, 70 and trying to fight for her memory. In which case, that's awesome. And sometimes people will want to say, you know, it's hundreds of years later, and I don't even know if Queen Abigail was even a real person. And that's also awesome. So that's left vague, because I want the setting to be about the characters, essentially.
A lot of problems role-playing story games have is getting a group of disparate people together, you know, to work for a common goal, or to work as a group. You know, D&D has the classic adventuring party thing, but it's a very artificial setup, necessarily, for practically any other game. How do you get different thought criminals to work together, or do they not?
The default baseline is that they don't. And so the way that play works is during any given scene, it is someone's criminal's scene, and it is about them. What do you do? What's your crime? Someone sitting across the table from them will play the inspectors. You know, how do we try and track you down? If we do track you down, where do we go from there? And we take turns rotating around the table doing that, just spotlight scenes. This is similar to how Polaris works or how Shock works. Now, there are opportunities in the game to play as one another's secret contacts, mm-hmm. and to band together for collaborative crimes. So if cool interwoven storylines emerge, there's mechanics to support that, but the default is we're all on our own here.
So do you think that aspect where you are occasionally not playing your character but playing somebody in conflict with one of the other characters, do you think that's one of the things that delineates a story game from a traditional role-playing game?
I think it can. I think that when people say story game, what they typically mean to communicate is, hey, there's some new kind of newfangled mechanics in here, newfangled structures of play, and basically we've thought about a lot the type of experience we want to deliver, and we've designed mechanics for that. So, in some cases, yes.
What is different about the new version of Perfect that you just put out? We're talking about the game Perfect, in case I didn't say that at the top of the story here. So, this is a Perfect unrevised but yet I know it's different from the version of Perfect that I have sitting on my shelf.
It is, yeah. The Perfect Unrevised is a kind of a wink and a nod to the history rewriting dystopian elements of the game. But yeah, so in 2006, I published Perfect. And at the time, the game had a GM. That was one of the major differences. The way that contacts and secret societies worked was different. That's another big difference. In 2006, I was really excited about the game, and I rushed, and I completed it, or I published it before it was really complete, and it was really polished, and before it was perfect, really. And I felt a lot of regret. Like, I felt really foolish about that decision, and I decided, well, I'm going to take it back, and I'm going to revise it, and I'm going to tweak it, and I'm going to, you know, republish it when it actually is a bit more polished. And in the back of my mind, I was like, oh, that'll take 5 or 6 months, you know, a quick cleanup. And so 4 years later, almost, you know, 4.5 years later, I finally put out the unrevised.
So how much of the unrevising is based on you just sitting down and thinking about what you wanted in the game and how you wanted to approach it, and how much of it is based on you actually playtesting it, you know, running it at things like SteamCon and whatnot?
There were long periods where I spent just kind of thinking on it and ruminating on it and giving myself breathing space and then coming back to it with fresh perspective. But almost everything that made it into the text came about through playtests. So in the space where I was revising it, there were over 100 playtests. There was over 100 playtesters involved.
How experienced were your playtesters when it came to playing, you know, story games and role-playing games?
That was really varied. I would say, I think there was probably 5 or 6 people that I played Perfect with who had never played a story game or a role-playing game before. Not even D&D, not even improv. And then I was playing with a lot of designers, and then I was playing with a lot of kind of players of average experience. So pretty varied.
What of those types of players, who did you find most rewarding for the end result product? Who gave you the most feedback, really approached it in ways that opened up your mind to seeing the game in a way that you hadn't originally seen it?
I think that would be probably new players, players who had never played anything before. And I think that's not just true for Perfect, but true for if you're playtesting any game, or even if you're playing any game, because those people aren't walking in with a whole bunch of, you know, pre-existing notions about what role-playing is. And so they say, can I do this? Can I do this? Can I do this? And if you're willing to go with it, if you're willing to say, sure, I mean, I didn't think that was possible, but yeah, why not? Then that's really rewarding. You can open up a lot of new play space that way.
So, okay, walk us through an example game of Perfect for those who have, you know, have yet to play the game.
All right. So at the start of the game, we would go through creating characters. And let's say I would create a character whose name's Thomas. Thomas is a, you know, a well-to-do governor. Governors being an entirely, like, powerless, kind of just, you know, for prestige only kind of position. But I'm a well-to-do governor who can't seem to sleep at night unless, you know, he set fire to a couple buildings that day. And you are Elizabeth, a kind of a shopkeep, trying to support a family of far too many on far too little. And gee, there's a bank next door. And if only you were to, you know, just take a little bit of extra money, you'd be able to make it in the world. So let's say we start with my character.
Sure.
We're going to start with a crime scene. And I'm going to say, you know, I'm just going to describe the crime that Thomas commits.
So you don't sit down and talk about the preparation of what you would do. You would just sit there and literally narrate out the crime as you have committed it.
Yeah, the way a crime scene works is you are automatically successful in whatever crimes it is that you're wanting to do. If you want to rob a bank, you know, fine. If you want to set fire to the parliament buildings, fine. If you want to sneak red roses, which are illegal, to your lover late at night, fine. This isn't a game about are you effective. That's not really a very interesting question to me. It's about when you're forced to pay for your actions, how do you hold up? So the crime scene, I describe my crime scene. And at the end of that, you as the law player are going to ask me a question. You're going to ask, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much did that matter to your character? And I say, it mattered a 7. And then you ask of the audience, or in this case, in a two-player game, of yourself, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much does society care? Maybe also a 7. We combine those scores. That gives you some points. We move on to a discovery phase, where the inspectors try to catch Thomas. And there's some dice mechanics at work there. There's kind of an extended test that stretches across the scene. And we find out whether or not Thomas gets caught for setting fire to the parliament buildings.
One of the things I was... Actually, that's very different than the first version of Perfect. And actually, that's one of the things I found striking about the first game is that, yes, you automatically committed your crime, but yes, you were automatically caught. So this is very different than the original version. All right, so there's essentially a trying to catch you scene. What happens if the criminal doesn't get caught? Is this the end of that narration?
Almost. We move on to a reflection scene. So the four scene types are crime scene, discovery scene, retribution scene, reflection scene. So let's say Thomas did get caught. So we can kind of carry this example out a bit further. He did get caught, which means you have some options. Are you gonna angle for establishing guilt, kind of like messing with his psyche, making him feel like maybe he's the bad guy, not these inspectors? Are you gonna just capture him and bring him in and interrogate him, or sit him down in one of those brainwashing rooms and attempt to condition him? We do another extended eye test, and we find out whether you succeed in breaking Thomas's spirits in whatever way you choose. We move on to a reflection, which maybe is about Thomas, you know, having been caught and interrogated, still returning home and sleeping like a baby because, well, he set fire to the Parliament buildings. That's the end of Thomas's cycle of scenes, and we skip over to Elizabeth. Now, what does Elizabeth do as her crime?
Well, she's going to steal money. She's going to start by, you know, stealing small things theoretically and moving her way up, right? Or I could start big. I'll start big.
Okay. So you start big, or are you just breaking into the bank then?
I'm going to break into the bank. Going to dig under the floorboards and break into banks, like you do.
So one of the things is the book sets up kind of the expectation that when someone's doing their crime scene, the other players at the table are asking questions, asking provocative questions, getting to the heart of the matter. So I'm going to ask then, is Elizabeth, you know, is she comfortable as she's digging this, like, tunnel through the earth, or is this terrifying to her?
Well, she's a little claustrophobic, so it makes her nervous.
She's a little claustrophobic. I'm going to, you know, keep that in the back of my mind. I'm going to probably, you know, if I get a chance, work that in later. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much does this matter to Elizabeth?
To Elizabeth, it matters about an 8.
Yeah. How much does it matter to society, I ask myself? Well, she's attempting social mobility.
Which is forbidden.
And she's stealing from the government.
Also forbidden.
I'm going to say an 8 as well. I have 16 points. We go into the discovery phase. I actually have two options here.
Okay.
I can attempt to just straight up capture Elizabeth, or I can attempt to establish a hold, which is kind of a hold. And the way that works is in the narrative, if we take 1984 for an example, there's a great part, a great length of the book where Winston and Julia, they're getting away scot-free with their secret romances and all their little petty crimes. And, it's total bliss.
Right.
And then there's this moment where it's like, actually, we've been following you for months. We have cameras installed in your secret love shack. Like, really? Do you really think we're that stupid and weak? No. And so that's because that law player, which is racking up the holds, which are, you know, secrets and evidence that you build up and then you just drop on someone. So I'm not going to do that, though. I'm just going to go and attempt to catch her.
Okay.
And we roll dice. I succeed. We go into the retribution scene and I say, she's a weak little old lady. I'm going to stick her in a brainwashing room, and I'm going to attempt to fix her.
Okay.
And so we're going to go for a conditioning. And that means between everyone at the table, we decide what thing they're trying to brainwash into her. So with her trying to steal, break into the bank, it could be something about money.
Or teaching her to be comfortable in her position in life.
Mm-hmm. However, this is a pretty big deal. You're breaking into the bank. So I think they're going to try and brainwash into her, I can't handle money.
Okay.
Which is going to have horrible ramifications to her as a shopkeep, but they don't care.
Yep.
So we set up some kind of weird, maybe like an electroshock thing where, you know, there's money on the table and she can just take it, and whenever she attempts to, something like that, right? So we set up the scene, we play through that die thing again. I win, which means you can't handle money again. So on your character sheet, under conditionings, you're right, I can't handle money. And then reflection, which is where you have an outro vignette where you kind of reflect on how this impacted your character. So
I've been I tried to rob a place. I got busted. I got electroshocked. And then I sit here. I just essentially muse aloud over how my character is going to approach life now that she can't make money at what she's doing.
Mm-hmm. So. And so that's an actual cycle of those three or four scenes tends to take somewhere between 10 and 20 minutes of gameplay.
So not crazy long.
Not crazy long. And so if you got a group of three or four people, chances are you'll get about three crime cycles in each before the session's over, if you created characters at the start.
Right. What happens at the end? Is there a rule set up that you're building towards some sort of specific, you know, climax in the game?
There's two possible endgames that play can build towards. And it's not necessarily true that every character will reach one of them, but they exist and they're there. The first is hero, which is that you have an impact on Cadent society, and you are remembered, and you have a legacy attached to your crimes. You can't topple Cadence. You can't break the society and set the world free. That's not in the cards. However, you could go down as a sort of a Robin Hood type character.
Okay.
So that's hero, and that's one of those options. The other one is broken, which is that once you rack up a certain amount of conditionings, that's it. You fall to pieces. You're a neurotic mess. You can barely get out of bed and go to work in the morning.
So is V for Vendetta a big influence on this?
Yes, definitely. I would say my top influences are, top five would probably be V for Vendetta, A Clockwork Orange, 1984, Quills, and okay, I lied. Those are my top four.
Top four. Okay, so a lot of people play role-playing games because they're fun. This doesn't sound like most people's idea of fun. How do you get people excited about the game, about something so grim, where at best you can hope for is being a good memory and... you know, it just gets horribly, horribly worse from there.
So I have two answers for that. The first is I've never encountered an experience where I have to convince someone that it's going to be fun, or someone saying, why would I want to play that? When I say you're a criminal and you get to fight for what you want, pick anything you want, it's probably illegal, and people probably want to capture you and brainwash you for it, people are excited to play that.
Okay.
So the first answer is, well, I've never had to experience that. That's kind of a douchey answer, though. So my other answer is... I personally play story games for rewarding stories and for rewarding moments and rewarding experiences, and fun factors into that. But there's lots of games where we're telling, you know, heavy, dramatic stuff that, you know, that drips with kind of risk and suspense, and it's not exactly fun. Just like No Country for Old Men wasn't exactly a fun movie to watch, but I would watch that again at the drop of a hat.
See, this work. I thought it was a hilarious movie. But that's just me.
Different strokes. My point was, I loved it, and I didn't find it to be fun. I was like, ooh, this is really hard to endure at times.
Right.
But rewarding to endure as well.
Both of the two examples that you just gave are essentially fairly realistic, gritty examples of characters you can play. How cinematic can you take the game? I mean, can you make this a game about being an airship pirate?
You could, yeah. There would be a lot of questions early on, and they would involve questions like, so... how did you invent an airship? You know, why did you invent an airship? Ultimately, it would still be about you as a human, your motivations, and you struggling to keep those motivations, you know, keep faith in those motivations. Whether there's airships or not doesn't change the human drama that's at the core of the game. I rarely see airship. I more often see people trying to smuggle love letters to people that they shouldn't be seen with.
So this is a game about deep, sort of quiet personal emotion.
I would say often. It's also a game about, I'm a dock worker, my whole life I've been oppressed, I'm just going to set some fire to some stuff, and then when the bad guys show up, I'm just going to start setting fire to them.
So you keep using fire as an example. Does that say something about who you are and what you want out of this game?
I often play arsonists, yeah.
Okay.
One of the things at the start of the game, part of creating your character early on is picking from a list of 10 archetypes. And you pick between 1 and 3, and these don't have any mechanical impact on the game, but what they do is they set up flags. They say, this is what my character is about, this is what they care about, this is how they go about doing their criminal business. And I can't remember them all, but they're like archivist, anarchist, idealist, romantic, inquisitor, vandal, sadist. Maybe I can do them all. One other one. Romantic, vandal are almost always the two that I pick.
Right.
There's just so much like room in that pair, and at first they seem so strikingly different, but then you're like, no, they fit together beautifully, in fact. And so I end up playing a lot of pyros.
Very nice. In the real Victorian society, you know, the church obviously had its place and some import. Is there a church in Cadence? Does religion play a part in everyday life?
There is a Church of Abigail. Now that Abigail is departed, she has been elevated to the realm of God. And whether there was a Christian church before that or another religion before Abigail's arrival in this setting isn't really clear. If there was, it's certainly been written out of history.
So it's just another aspect of the cult of personality of the lost Abigail.
Exactly, yeah. I figured out my fifth influence. It's Gotham by Gaslight.
Oh, I love that. Well, the first one. The second one was a little... not as strong.
Yeah, I've only read the first one, so there you go.
I'll have to. It's sitting over there on the shelf somewhere. I'll have to pull it off for you when we're done. if I can find it.
A big part of my design work that I was doing in 2009 was based on having read Gotham by Gaslight, in which Batman is hunting Jack the Ripper, and Jack the Ripper is kind of setting up this big setup on Batman, right? And Jack the Ripper's plan is kind of that Batman will be, you know, tucked away in prison forever, and he'll be free to roam the streets. And that dynamic between those two characters, I spent a lot of time working on creating foils that worked outside of the government system, outside of the inspectors. In the end, I realized it was actually kind of diluting the core dynamic, which I really liked. But I spent a lot of mental real estate thinking, how do I make Gotham by Gaslight work?
There's another Batman Elseworlds one. I can't remember the name of it. Batman is... Bruce Wayne is a priest, and his father was actually an underground abortionist in this totalitarian American society. And I actually think that seems to be almost more apropos to what you're doing than actually Gotham by Gaslight, because it's about Bruce Wayne finding out that his, you know, father was essentially executed by a goon squad for being an abortionist.
I have never read that. That sounds absolutely amazing.
I cannot remember the name of it for the life of me, but I used to have it once upon a time.
That reminds me of another source, which is Vera Drake, which is a movie about a kind of a middle-aged woman who is a back alley abortionist, and she's very much about like I'm in this to help the girls, you know, and then she's caught by police who are like, what you're doing is a crime, you are a criminal, you are a bad and sinful person, and we are going to break you in two, and that's actually the one kind of media source that inspired Perfect that has a female protagonist rather than just a female secondary or a romantic interest. And unfortunately, it didn't end so well for her.
So she doesn't... Well, she doesn't become Robin Hood, or she...
No, she ends broken.
Right. Just like, what's his name, Winston in 1984.
Exactly, yeah. So, yeah, the two endgame mechanics basically lead you to either... the end of V for Vendetta, or the end of 1984.
Anyway, this is VictorianAdventureEnthusiast.com. This is the first time I've ever recorded an interview, so probably don't sound like I know what I'm doing, and I'm talking to Joe McDaldno, who has developed the game Perfect, which is in its second version called Perfect Unrevised.
And if you wanted to know more, you could go to www.buriedwithoutceremony.com/perfect.
So what other kind of games have you made? You know, it's not your first game you've written.
No, actually, well, it was my first game that I wrote, and then in the meantime, since I have been revising and publishing it, I've written others. Two that I have for sale also on that website. One is called Gun Thief, and it is about a down-and-out thug trying to make it in the world, and all these vixens leading him down dark alleyways, and all these men out there to double-cross and betray him. So it kind of plays... like Sin City and Black Snake Moan and kind of that kind of thug crime grime genre. Another one is Ribbon Drive, which is a game about road trips and self-discovery that plays... It's very close to Freeform, and a lot of the mechanics revolve around mixtapes that people make before play and then bring to the game.
Those of you who are too young, mixtapes were things you used to make where you recorded different songs and put them on some sort of media and gave it to other people. It existed back in the 80s when there were things called guitar solos and songs. You might want to look those up. So is this the perfect version of Perfect, or now that this is out, now the new version is out, and you're getting to play it with more people, you're going to get more feedback, do you think there's a future version of Perfect out there?
I don't think so, no. The game has... the mechanics of the game have been locked in and have been finished since May. And so it's been all press time, maybe preparing for press since then. And in that time, I've played the game again, and I'm like, yes, this works. This is perfect.
Do you think the setting, the world of Cadence, is essential to get the experience that you want out of this game? Could you play, you know, thought criminals in another setting using these rules and still get the same result?
You wouldn't get the same result. You would get different, interesting results. About 2008, 2009, I started experimenting with the idea that maybe Perfect would be a settingless game and Cadence would be an option, but creating your own setting would be another option. And creating your own setting on the fly for this game actually wasn't very fun, but in the process I realized actually there are these three or four other settings that I really want to play around with at some point. And so in the future, it's likely that you will see other states, a supplement detailing 3 to 4 other states for Perfect, as well as rules for playing Perfect as a Jeep Form LARP.
Oh, excellent. All right. Well, again, I have been Mr. Bodewell from Victorian Adventure Enthusiast. It was super nice to talk to notorious Canadian Joe McDaldno about his new version of his game, Perfect Unrevised. Take care.